that is all contingent on getting all the permits, legal certainty, and then our own determination that we're prepared to do it safely and responsibly.
Shell comes one step closer to federal approval to drill in the Arctic. Lawmakers send a gas from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 31st. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Democratic lawmakers propose a change to the state's oil tax system.
It's a failed system. It's something that needs to be fixed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer in the United States, but is actually highly preventable through screening. If you are 50 or older, talk with your doctor about colon screening today. Learn more at alaskacolonhealth.org. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
Shell's effort to resume exploratory drilling in the Chukchi Sea has cleared another hurdle. The Interior Department today approved the 2008 Arctic lease sale, where Shell spent more than $2 billion to purchase drilling rights. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
A court challenge forced the government to re-examine the environmental impact of the sale. That's why the feds are announcing their approval now of an auction that actually took place 7 years ago. The decision clears the way for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management to officially consider Shell's offshore drilling plan. Shell hopes to send two rigs to the Chukchi this summer, with each serving as the relief rig for the other in case of a blowout. Shell drilled two partial wells in Arctic waters in 2012 in a season beset by problems. Company spokeswoman Megan Baldino says the affirmation of the lease sale means Shell can proceed with its plans for Arctic drilling, but it isn't the final green light.
Of course, that is all contingent on getting all the permits, legal certainty, and then our own determination that we're prepared to do it safely and responsibly.
In a written statement announcing the decision, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell called the Arctic an important component of the administration's national energy strategy and says they are taking a balanced approach. Earth Justice Attorney Eric Graffy, who filed the environmental challenge against the lease sale, says he's disappointed in what he describes as a rushed process.
But Interior still has time to make better decisions when evaluating Shell's drilling plan, and we sincerely hope that it says no to that plan.
Graffy says he'll continue to monitor the regulatory process, which will include a public comment period on Shell's exploration plan. He says each of his clients, mostly environmental groups, will have to evaluate whether to continue. Meanwhile, Shell has two drilling rigs underway from Asia, the Polar Pioneer and the Noble Discoverer, a drillship it also used in 2012. The rigs are heading into the North Pacific. A Greenpeace ship is in pursuit, with activists on board blogging photos. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Alaska legislature has passed a bill meant to keep Governor Bill Walker from spending money on an alternate gas line proposal. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports the action is part of an ongoing power struggle between Republican leadership and the governor over the state's most high-profile mega project.
It's the legislative equivalent of two semi-trucks playing chicken. The governor has said he would veto the bill. The legislature nearly has the number to override him, and no one's really sure who will win. For days, Governor Bill Walker and Republican leadership have been in talks over what terms would be needed to stop House Bill 132 from coming to a vote. But on Tuesday, after an hour of closed-door caucus meetings and plenty of scurrying by legislative staff, the bill hit the Senate floor. A compromise had not been reached. Senator Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican, carried the bill, saying it's a matter of the legislature asserting itself.
This basically just underscores what we did the past 2 years on gas pipeline projects and substantiates that we are the policy body, the branch of government, equal branch of government that establishes policy and appropriation authority.
The bill itself is basically an affirmation of the gas line bill passed by the legislature last year, which sets the state up to partner with Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips on a project to get North Slope gas to market at a cost of at least $45 billion. The bill that passed on Tuesday prevents the governor from exploring a competing plan by taking a smaller gas line project known as the Alaska Standalone Pipeline and morphing it into a big one. While supporters of the bill argued that it was needed to protect the bigger AK LNG project, opponents, like Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, worried it would weaken the state's bargaining position.
So I'm really hesitant to tie our chief executive's hands at the negotiating table.
Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski argued the bill had not been thoroughly vetted and that it was being rushed through the legislature. Because law requires the bill to be transmitted to the governor by April 1st to allow time during the session for a veto override, the bill received only one Senate committee hearing before being scheduled for the floor. The producers had not been invited to testify on it. Willikowski also worried that the conflict between the legislature and governor could jeopardize the construction of any project.
Us voting on this, I think, sends a bad message that we're fighting amongst ourselves, and I think that's very dangerous.
The bill passed 13-7, with Stedman joining the legislature's six Democrats in opposition. That number leaves uncertainty over the bill's fate. The legislature needs a two-thirds vote to override the governor's promised veto. If all of the lawmakers who voted against the bill in the House and the Senate maintain their opposition, leadership falls short of the 40 votes it needs. House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Nikiski Republican who sponsored the bill, addressed the matter in a post-vote press conference.
You know, the numbers are what they are. I would love to have had 18 or 19 votes on the Senate side, and I'd love to have had 30 on the House side. If he does veto it, then we'll be working with the members that, not only the members that voted yes, but certainly talking to the members that voted no.
He and Senate President Kevin Meyer plan to continue negotiations with the governor. They stressed that the sticking point is the money the legislature has already appropriated for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. Meyer says if the bill fails or if some sort of agreement is not reached with the governor,
he has the ability to spend $180 million on a backup plan that none of us know anything about.
The governor declined an interview request, but his press secretary wrote in an email that he still planned to veto the bill. In written statements, Exxon and BP reiterated their commitment to the existing Alaska LNG project. ConocoPhillips did not respond to a request for comment. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
With just 3 weeks left in the legislative session, a pair of Anchorage Democrats are offering what they describe as an emergency fix to Alaska's oil tax system. Senator Bill Willikowski and Representative Les Guerra say they would like to see the tax floor raised from 4% to 12.5% and certain credits ended in order to bring in more revenue to the state. The state's oil tax structure has been debated exhaustively ever since the Trans-Alaska Pipeline came online. Last year, a referendum sought to repeal the tax legislation pushed by former Governor Sean Parnell. The referendum failed, but narrowly. At a press conference today, Willikowski argued that adjusting the oil tax system was fundamentally different from current efforts to weaken marijuana legislation. He noted that the state constitution has separate rules for referenda and initiatives. He added that the current oil tax regime has been given enough time to work.
It's a failed system. It's something that needs to be fixed. And I would respectfully say it's apples and oranges.
Last week, Governor Bill Walker told the Associated Press that he has no current plans to revisit the oil production tax. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers debate the 1% for Public Art program.
I think it's really important that the places we live in and work in don't look like buildings you can just find in Kansas or Ohio.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The University of Alaska Southeast has more online learning programs than any other university in Alaska. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
A few months before the king salmon begin to enter the river, the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group met to set recommendations for an early season of conservation. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
In a breakout session of the first ever Kuskokwim Fishermen's Meeting, small groups began by tackling the big question of how to fairly share king salmon along the Kuskokwim River. At one table, Barb Carlson of Sleetmute peppered Timothy Jacob of Nipusgiak with questions about how he and his family fish.
Did it work down this far?
It's working all right, only for silver.
The meeting brought together dozens of fishermen and a large contingent of federal and state biologists at the ONC Multipurpose Building. As the state again expects to start the season with stiff conservation measures, they want to get buy-in from the subsistence fishermen who shoulder the sacrifices and get ideas for how to make it less painful. Last year's harvest of 12,000 king salmon was the lowest on record. The river made its drainage-wide escapement goal after the unprecedented restrictions, but the fishery has been in decline for years. John Zeller lives in Red Devil, 200 miles above Bethel. He says he doesn't often speak with people who live near the mouth of the river and said Thursday's meeting was a chance for people from different areas to try to find better ways to tackle the Chinook crisis.
Well, we got a problem and we need a solution, so maybe with all of us together, we can get a solution.
Management biologist Aaron Potter told the Full House that the plan is not yet set in stone, but conservation is at the top of their priorities. They're again considering starting the season closed, having some 4-inch set net fishing, as well as limited 6-inch gill net openings for other species of salmon as the run allows. At this point, he says he wants more ideas and more communication.
For me, it's fantastic to see users from all over the drainage sitting together in their little breakout groups discussing these issues. I'm really excited to see what the end results are going to be from this.
The groups included strategically paired fishermen from all parts of the river with federal and state staff who brainstormed ideas. They touched on variations of household permits, fishing schedules, bag limits, and community fish wheels. They shared ideas like limiting jet boats and even using fish fences to selectively harvest different salmon species. A couple months before summer, there are still several moving pieces. The Federal Subsistence Board is considering special action to federalize the Yukon and Kuskokwim salmon fisheries near federal lands, which could give day-to-day management duties to refuge staff. And the federal government has announced a demonstration co-management project. Exactly what officials will develop is unknown now, but the Association of Village Council Presidents is proposing an aggressive schedule to put a tribal co-management regime in place next year through the project. AVCP President Myron Nanning made clear that he wants more than roundtable discussions.
Because of frustration with the systems that are in place of management of the fisheries, by people who don't live in the region, and I don't mean to be offensive to the fish and game people, but I feel that they're just like hibernators. They hibernate in Anchorage and come out here during the summertime to make determination for us of when to fish or when not to fish.
Something Nanning says has to change, and he's hoping that this year will be the start. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Alaska Court of Appeals has affirmed a lower court's decision that Yupik fishermen who fished for king salmon during a state closure should be convicted. The decision was issued Friday. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
The attorney for the fishermen is James Davis with the Northern Justice Project. He says the court asked the wrong question.
The court asked, should the Yupik fishers be allowed to catch any fish when there are no fish to be caught? and got the wrong answer, which is no, they shouldn't be allowed to catch any fish.
In 2012, dozens of Yupik Alaska Native fishermen living a subsistence lifestyle were charged with violating the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's emergency orders when they fished for king salmon on the Kuskokwim River. 13 defendants are appealing. The defendants moved for dismissal of the charges, asserting that their fishing for king salmon was a religious activity and that they were entitled to a religious exemption from the emergency orders under the Free Exercise Clause of the Alaska Constitution. Davis says there are two right questions he asked the court to consider and they ignored.
If there were no king salmon to be caught by the Yupik fishers, why did the state open up the fishery to allow 20,000 king salmon to be caught the very next week after citing the Yupik fishers for catching any king salmon? And the second question, which the court ignored as if it hadn't been asked, is if there were declining runs of king salmon on the river over the last few years, why did the state continually vote for high salmon bycatch by the pollock fleet, which the Court of Appeals effectively ignored?
Davis says he plans to appeal the case to the Alaska Supreme Court. Myra Nanning is president of the Association of Village Council Presidents, the regional tribal nonprofit. He says their organization is pleased the case will be appealed, but they're also considering taking the case to federal court.
We should have gone to the federal court in the first place because the feds did not do their responsibility under Title 8 of ANILCA Section 807, where they're required to give priority to rural Alaska and that they're supposed to have federal management first instead of requiring the state of Alaska to issue citations like they did back in 2012. That's something that we're going to be looking into.
Federal managers took over the Chinook fishery in 2014 and have requests to take over management again this season. Nanning cites a case from the 1970s upon which Attorney Davis's case for the fishermen was built, Frank versus the State of Alaska, in which a judge ruled an Athabaskan man from the Minto area could take moose out of season for a funeral potlatch on religious grounds.
When there's death in families, there's a law in the state of Alaska that currently exists where families can go harvest a moose for religious purposes. And we feel that being able to harvest salmon for food as well as for, you know, for the well-being of to feed our families, that's part of our life and has been our livelihood.
Nanning and Davis reason that the Yupik Alaska Native fishermen's spiritual connection to the salmon as their primary food source should be reason enough for the religious exemption. Laura Fox is the assistant attorney general with the state who argued the case before the Court of Appeals. She says the decision is sound.
The Court of Appeals decision is a good decision, and it agrees with the arguments that the state made, and it will allow the state to continue to protect threatened fisheries by enforcing fishing restrictions when necessary, when there's a shortage like there was on the Kuskokwim in 2012.
The district court said the state's responsibility to protect the declining species of fish outweighed the men's claim of religious rights. The Court of Appeals decision affirms the lower court's decision. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Getting your fishing and hunting license just got a whole lot easier. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has launched its new online store, streamlining the permitting process for many prospective anglers and hunters. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The new store boasts several new features, including buying and printing your sport fishing and hunting licenses at home. Michelle Kelke is the licensing supervisor at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
When you finish your transaction, you are sent an email with your license attached to it, so you can print it at your convenience whenever you get to a printer.
Previously, when a customer bought a hunting or fishing license online, Fish and Game would process the application and mail the license. King salmon and duck stamps will also be printed directly onto the licenses purchased online. Kelke says another change is allowing customers to purchase more than one license per transaction online.
So for your whole family, you can purchase all your fishing and hunting licenses in one transaction. And also we have hunting and fishing lodges who purchase their licenses for their clients. And so now they can purchase all those licenses in one transaction.
The new system also allows commercial fishermen to purchase their licenses online, which was not allowed in the past. Kelke says there is another major digital update in the works.
Our next project that we're working on is going to be mobile selling, you know, or showing your license on a mobile device. and rather than any type of paper.
Though the exact numbers aren't clear, Kelke says Fish and Game expects substantial savings on everything from labor to printing to postage. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Registration is open for the Alaska Trails 2015 Trails Conference, April 23rd to the 25th in Wasilla. Agenda and more information at alaska-trails.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Trails. The men and women of Public Employees Local 71 maintain over 20,000 miles of roads and runways and cook and care for those in Alaska's pioneer homes. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska, working hard for you. This message is sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
The State Department of Transportation released its first draft of a plan to reroute the Sterling Highway around Cooper Landing. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports.
Officially, what we're looking at is a draft supplemental environmental impact statement and draft selection for the Sterling Highway between mileposts 45 and 60, the long sought-after Cooper Landing bypass.
We have four different build alternatives that just take a look at the area and offer different options of how to improve the highway.
That's DOT spokesperson Shannon McCarthy. The cheapest of all those options she mentioned is, of course, to do nothing. But this particular stretch of highway has some problems. It's slow and winding. There are a bunch of hidden driveways to dodge. It's really busy in the summer and not the comfiest bit of driving for RVs and semis. Plus, it doesn't meet certain federal standards for rural highways anymore. The four alternatives range in cost from $250 to more than $300 million. One path would take travelers south of Cooper Landing over 3.5 miles of new road, including new bridges over the Kenai River and an additional one over Cooper Creek. Two plans would send the road further north and across Juneau Creek, while a fourth would also carve a path to the north but avoid Juneau Creek Falls and the Resurrection Pass Trail.
We really do need the public to review this, to weigh in, give us their comments, and then we can take that information forward and make a final determination with the Federal Highway Administration.
The public comment period is open through May 26th, but in some ways it's been open a lot longer than that. The first draft plan for a Cooper Landing bypass was drawn up back in 1982. That was shelved and brought up again in 1994, and since the year 2000, this current plan has been slowly put together. The project has its own website, sterlinghighway.net, and the timeline there shows a decision on a bypass being made sometime next year, with construction beginning as soon as 2018. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
State lawmakers are considering a bill that would end a program that dedicates money for art in public buildings. Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican, sponsored the bill, which gets rid of a requirement that 1% of funds for public projects like schools and courthouses go toward art. It would allow the Alaska Council on the Arts to spend their remaining fund balance over the next 5 years, but then shut down the program at that point. Gaddis said she introduced the legislation because of the state's $4 billion revenue shortfall.
In no way am I saying that those artists should not continue their artwork and try to sell it. All this says is the state will no longer be sponsoring them in the same manner.
The Percent for Art in Public Places program was established in 1975, and the public testimony that was offered on Tuesday defended it. Democrats on the committee, like Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins of Sitka, also argued that the program was needed for the character of the state.
I think it's really important that the places we live in and work in don't look like buildings you could just find in Kansas or Ohio. Nothing against Kansas or Ohio.
The average annual cost of the program is about $1 million. Lawmakers are passing bills to recognize March 27th as the official Remembrance Day of the Good Friday earthquake that struck Alaska 51 years ago. In the legislature, House Bill 35 is awaiting Governor Bill Walker's signature. Independently, the Anchorage Assembly passed its own local version last week. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, both efforts came about because of the same man.
Chuck Valenti was only 24 years old when Alaska was hit by the most powerful earthquake ever recorded in North America.
And I was working at the Alaska National Guard during the time of the quake. And that evening is an evening that I will never forget.
Valenti was part of a four-man unit in the Air National Guard. Weeks after the quake, the crew was on a humanitarian mission to Valdez. As they flew out, ahead of bad weather, the plane went down, killing three guardsmen, as well as Adjutant General Thomas Carroll, who was with them. Valenti was not on board, and is the only survivor from the office. The seed for the Remembrance Day resolutions was planted when he visited Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in 2013.
But I wanted to put a wreath at the Wall of Honor in memory of fallen comrades, and to me, these men were more like family than anything else.
Last March, Governor Sean Parnell signed into law a bill recognizing March 27th as the 50th anniversary of the disaster. But as Valenti puts it, that was law for a day, and he felt the deceased, as well as the survivors, deserved something more lasting. So he brought the issue back up with House Republican Charisse Millette of Anchorage.
This legislation honors these people and remembers these people. So in a subsequent conversation with Representative Millett, I said, this is a date that should have been, or should be, for now and forever be remembered as a day of remembrance. And I said, Representative Millett, would you kindly consider sponsoring a bill, which she did do.
The bill passed both the House and Senate unanimously, but Valenti didn't stop there. He mentioned the issue to Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan, who helped get a local version of it in front of the Assembly. It makes sure flags fly at half-mast, and clergy in Anchorage and elsewhere have agreed to toll their bells to mark the date each year. They are symbolic steps that Assembly Chair Dick Traney says carry forward the lessons learned after the quake.
So the purpose of this is just to remind Alaskans about what happened in the past and what will happen again. Because there will be another earthquake. It's a matter of when it happens, not if.
Traney hopes the remembrance will remind residents to take steps to prepare, like having a 3-day supply of food and water at home. And though Valenti and his wife now live outside of Alaska, he says even after half a century, his work commemorating the quake isn't finished yet.
One of the last things I have left to do is I want to see some kind of a memorial or some kind of at least a little monument placed in Valdez in honor of this flight crew and this Alaska National Guard Adjutant General. And like I say, to me, these men were more like family than a formal military command.
The Anchorage resolution passed unanimously last Tuesday in the Assembly. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson and Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Join Alaska Public Media and participate in our statewide live online social screening and chat about the film The Home Stretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Be part of the conversation about homeless teens in our communities. More at alaskapublic.org. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.